Premium Hoops presents Sense and Scalability.
Sense and Scalability. Well, last time we talked, guys, it was about Bucks Nets preview, and I felt really dumb, and then I still felt really dumb, and then I felt smart, then I felt dumb again. What a weird series. Evan, how you doing?
Doing great, Scott. The entire second round was just like banger after banger. I think this might be one of the best 1 to 2 week stretches of games that I've ever been alive and witnessing. So it's been a ton of fun. We've got takes. We've got hot takes. We've got probably future cold takes. We're going to break down how our philosophies have changed based off the second round today, which is an extremely SNS topic. There's every so often these podcasts where we just come in and we're hanging out before we hit record and we're just like, yeah, this one's going to be a banger. And this is one of those episodes. So hope the listeners are ready because this is going to be a lot of fun.
And for reference, we reserve the right to, in a couple months, say, hey, you know what? I overreacted to that playoff series and it's not as important as I thought. But God damn it, we're in the present right now and we're going to live our lives and think our thoughts. So we might come in hot, but that's okay. That's how we're feeling right now. How you doing, Cody?
I'm just flying high right now, especially after that Bucks game 7. But I mean, I agree with you, Evan. There was like three straight days where we had like the Clippers 25-point comeback. Then the next night was Nets Bucks game 7, and the next night was Hawks and I'm blanking right now. Hawks Sixers game 7. And just, I can't remember a better 3-day stretch of watching basketball before. But just like Ben Taylor and David Thorpe are talking about on his podcast, I got to know when to get the ball back to our main creator. So Scott, I'm going to let you run the show because there's a lot of different directions that I could go right now. And I'm going to let you run this show.
I'm not a heliocentric creator, so you're totally okay. But speaking of which, let's start with the Bucks because that's fresh on Cody and our mind right now. I was ready to kind of write the obituary after 2 games and then after 5 games. And we're going to talk a lot about like how our perspective on creation has changed from these games and how that doesn't favor what the Bucks do. But, you know, one way or another, through some bad injury luck on the Nets, through some timely plays by the Bucks, through Giannis kind of putting it together, the Bucks advance to the Eastern Conference Finals for the first time since 2019. And I guess I just want to get a vibe check before we start, because that is always a question, how Cody feels about the Bucks. Sometimes Cody doesn't even know. So I'll let you kind of start with how you're feeling about the team going into the Eastern Conference Finals.
On June 7th, here is a tweet that I sent out for the public to read, for the world to know. And it read thusly, I hope that no Bucks fans are looking for optimism from me. I have none. This is a convincing 2-0 lead from Brooklyn. Milwaukee is done. Basketball is dumb. That was my take 2 games into this series. And here we are celebrating a Bucks Game 7 victory. Did it take a couple of injuries that I admittedly never cheer for any kind of injury? But a win's a win. You got to play the game of basketball however it's presented to you. And the Bucks were ultimately, by the inch of Kevin Durant's toe, able to hang on to that and take out the series. And I really don't know what to think right now, because the Bucks, those first 2 games are probably like the 2 worst games I've ever seen a team play in the playoffs, especially one that had such high expectations. They were a complete and total mess. And I think that Scott, you and I especially talked about this a lot on our Discord, just about how we were really disappointed in them. I think Nate came in and he was like, oh, I'm going to catch up. What if they make a comeback? And we're like, no, stop it. There's just no comeback. There's absolutely no way they recover from this. And somehow they did. So I don't know what my vibe check is besides complete jubilance, because I'm looking at the rest of the field and I'm like, the Bucks have a pretty solid chance of winning it all. I mean, I'm not saying that they're going to, you know, run to the championship, but this is the best chance that they've had in a really, really long time.
Yeah, I was also like, I had 2 of those moments. I had after game 2 and then after game 5, where it's like, wow, the Bucks can't even beat like a hobbled Harden and KD. You know, did I choose to ignore that KD had perhaps the game of his life to pile on the Bucks, absolutely. But I was just so sick of this team. I was so sick of Giannis. Even though you look down and he's shooting like 13 for 20, it just seems like he had to force so many shots. And that did kind of change in game 6 and game 7, which we can probably get into in a second. But I just can't quit the Bucks. I was rooting for them like no other against the Nets game 7. And it made me so happy to see Chris Middleton show up the way he did. That is just a player for the ages. Like, I don't know how I'm going to explain Chris Middleton to future generations. Like, I've already kind of created a ban of like, you can't compare guys to Chris Middleton in the draft, because I think PD said it best. He's a combination of low ceiling skills that all somehow form a high ceiling player, where he's not going to burn his man. He's not going to make these crazy cross court reads, but the shooting is so good, and the angle manipulation and the ability to set his man up and kind of keep him off balance is so good that, and just like the way he's wired, his scoring feel, his feel for how much space he has for his jumper, it's all just there. It's all just a bunch of little things clicking together to make like a top 25 player in a way that I don't think we'll really see for a while.
Yeah. Sorry. Didn't mean to cut you off, Scott.
No, I was just going to say, I like Chris Middleton.
I love Chris Middleton. And I'm really happy for the Bucks. Things looked rough for sure for a while there. I think I was kind of on the same boat that Scott was as general neutrals when it comes to our support of the Bucks, who for the past couple seasons have bought into the Bucks hype and have been disappointed in the end. This year, especially after the 2-0 lead, I think we both said like, this is the last year I trust the Bucks. And just like Chris Middleton being kind of an aggregation of kind of those like low ceiling skills that become a high ceiling player, found a way to quote Jurassic Park, more or less, the Bucks found a way. And they've made it to the conference finals. The path is looking pretty decent for them, although I'm definitely not writing the Hawks off. And I'm sure we'll get into the Hawks just a little bit. But the Bucks found a way, and they found a way that is, I think, a little bit different than where at least my philosophy lately and the changes in my philosophy have been pointing as a result of a lot of these playoff games. And so I guess in that sense, while they're maybe the most favorited team to make it to the finals of the remaining four among consensus, depending on how you feel about the Suns, and the Suns are very good too. I don't know if the Bucks are going to be a point to the contrary of what I generally believe, or if they're going to become the way of the future. And we'll get into kind of the discussion of, you know, how our philosophies have changed and stuff like that. But yeah, the Bucks have just been a ton of fun. Not all the time, but the last couple games, like they pulled it out. And I'm excited to see how things go when they play the Hawks, because the Hawks are playing the best basketball of probably anyone in the playoffs, in my estimation, in the last couple games, especially the second round. So it's going to be a tough matchup for sure.
I think going back to Chris Middleton for a second, I think something that makes him really interesting to watch is when you watch even like Kevin Durant in that series, who, you know, I want to give as many shout outs as possible because cheering against him was really, really difficult. And even in cheering against him, I was just happy that I was witnessing such absurd, transcendent basketball playing. And that shot at the end of regulation in Game 7 was just an all-timer. Right after that Brook Lopez play, just an all-timer sucking the air out of the room. Just like, that's it. The Bucks screwed up. Kevin Durant came back, and he's going to win it all. But yeah, beyond the point, Kevin Durant's very good at creating space. Chris Middleton, I feel like, doesn't necessarily create space. He almost just invites no space before shooting. Like, he is tremendous at taking extraordinarily tightly contested shots and making them. And sometimes, like we saw in the first half of Game 7, that gets you 2 for 11 shooting, or 2 for 14, or 2 for 12, whatever it was. It was really bad shooting. But the second half, you can also see how they can buoy an offense, where it's just like, nope, I don't care how close you are. I'm going to rise up and fire, and I'm going to keep us afloat if I catch even just a hint of a heat check. And that's what makes Chris Middleton special, is that ability to score in that way.
So this podcast would have been a lot more convenient to talk about if the Bucks lost, because I think that you, Evan, you kind of hinted at it, and they kind of went against a lot of the stuff we felt that has worked in this playoffs. You look at the teams like the Suns, the Clippers, and the Hawks, and you look at how the Sixers lost, and you look at how maybe a team like the Nuggets lost without Jamal Murray. And it's like, it seems like the common thread among these teams is that they have multiple creators on the floor at any given time. And, you know, you could say that was the biggest reason Jazz lost as well, is just not having Mike Conley. Just because it seems like the teams that have the most backup plans are able to kind of withstand the most. We saw that like Sixers, you know, didn't have as many backup plans when Embiid wasn't cooking, when Tobias's shots weren't falling. You know, Seth Curry had to do a lot, way more than you might ask Seth Curry to do. And so, yeah, the Bucks are kind of not really that either. They kind of just have their main shots, and if one of them gets taken away, they often, you know, have to rely on those Chris Middleton followaways, which, you know, went in enough times, but don't always, you know, aren't always high percentage looks. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, seeing what we've seen and how, you know, teams with like Trey and Bogdanovich and you know, having Booker and even Cameron Payne, now that CP3 is hurt, you know, having these multi-pronged offenses seems to be hard to just scheme them into one thing. How have your guys' perspectives shifted in the playoffs, and what in particular has led to that?
That's a really big question, and I definitely want to go in a few different ways with that, but I'm going to go all the way back to our Wrong Initiator podcast, I think our very first one, especially because we were highlighting the Utah Jazz a lot there, where it's like, look at all these wing creators we have that can elevate Donovan Mitchell from maybe not a primary creator to being a very good primary creator. And we're like, this is a great ecosystem for an offense like this. But I think now what you want to do is you want to still have that primary creator, but then you want to surround that person with as many secondary creators as you can. And you want to pick and bias towards that over literally any other skill. And I think that's what's throwing me for a loop right now, is it's like, especially the Clippers right now, what they whipped out against Gobert and the Jazz, is just like, all right, we're going to put five guys out there that can shoot threes, that can put it on the deck, that can drive in, that can cause the defense to scramble and kick out, and we're just going to run you out of the gym. And it worked. And I see no evidence of being able to slow or stop that at all. So I think my biggest takeaways right now are still primary creation is important, but lots and lots of secondary creation is equally as important. A, B, I just don't know what the value of defense is right now. And I don't know how much impact a single defensive player can have on a game.
Yeah, that's a really big question, especially, you know, when you talk about the value a single player can have on defense and how important that defense really is if you're facing an elite offense that's cooking. And, you know, the way basketball is played right now, especially given the way the rules are set and the way the game is officiated, especially in terms of kind of the way those space creation moves, like the step back and the shooter's landing space are officiated. It's really difficult to play defense on the perimeter, first and foremost. And I think the big thing, this was something that I noted a ton watching the Bulls all year, watching Zach LaVine and Coby White try to guard on the perimeter and protect that shell as the first layer of defense in a drop scheme. The Jazz had similar issues. They were getting beat at point of attack consistently. And as good and as special a defensive player as Rudy Gobert is, one, the rules of verticality are officiated in a way that still does not favor the defending player, which makes it tough for him to clean up as much as he possibly can, even though he does an excellent job of it. And two, you have to clean up so many opportunities that even the best player in this role, Rudy Gobert, the best rim protector in the NBA, can't clean up for enough for it to make the difference between winning and losing, at least not in this circumstance. And I hesitate to make sweeping conclusions based off one series or even one year of playoffs, especially in this year, right? Which is an injury or a COVID shortened season, and off the back of a shortened off season and preceding another shortened off season. So this year is definitely weird, but yeah, there are real questions about you know, how meaningful is defense, especially rim protection, when it comes to more traditional schemes like drop, and you know, what does that mean for offenses or for teams that who build around kind of a defensive cornerstone, or who build an uneven defensive shell in the sense that one player is tasked with cleaning up after so many others? That's something that's really stuck out to me, even beside, like, you know, everything that you talked about, Cody, when you talk about primary creation. I've always kind of been, or at least in the past couple of years, have been of the opinion that primary creation is the most important skill set. But I think the difference between how important primary creation is and how important everything else is for me has widened a reasonably significant degree. And you see all these teams that are carried by like elite primaries, but also like very good secondaries who in many cases are underutilized in a secondary role, who could really create primarily to some extent themselves. Those are the teams that are going a lot further, I think, than we expected. So teams like the Atlanta Hawks, you mentioned with Trey, with Bogdanovich, and also with Kevin Herter, who was fantastic in this recent series. We've got Booker and CP3. That's two primaries right there, at least in my estimation. And then the Mitchell and Conley combo, you see what happens when a team gets one of their other primaries, or I guess, underutilized secondaries in Mike Conley hurt, and what that does to the load that Donovan Mitchell has to carry. So one, like, those tandems are super important, and they're even more important to me now than they were before. And two, and I tweeted about this today, I think it's important that we take a second and kind of recollect and consider some of the takes that we've seen about primary creators who have been on losing teams thus far in their career, and this season that's changed. So I'm thinking of guys like Trae Young, I'm thinking of guys like Devin Booker, Donovan Mitchell, Zach LaVine. In a lot of cases, these guys were cast as like quote unquote empty stats players, guys who put up gaudy numbers but don't win games. And I think we're seeing that primary creation is the most valuable skill because it's the hardest to be elite at. And it's the most important in these high leverage playoff games. It's also the most difficult to develop those sub skills to become a primary creator, or else we'd see more of these types of players. And it takes a while to do so. So I guess as a short aside, and I'll get off my soapbox here in a sec, but as somebody who does draft work too, like, just don't be so hard on these primary candidates so early on in their careers, especially just if the judgment is going to be made based off of, the team's record and the team's results without contextualizing what's around these players. As we've seen, that's so important. But yeah, primary creation is huge. Defense is worryingly emphasized, I guess, in the current meta, if you call it that. But yeah, Scott, I'm going to throw it back over to you, because I'm sure you have some thoughts on this as well.
I've been thinking a lot about, like, Cody's talked about, like, how important is defense in, like, the Discord. And to me, great offense beats great defense, but great defense can expose one-dimensional offense. So if you can successfully shut down one thing, that can stymie some teams. We've seen that in the Bucks with the past years. We might see it again if they just wall up the paint. We've seen it with the Sixers, where it's like, they sent the late doubles to Tobias and Embiid, who didn't really have a good job, weren't able to handle it because of the lack of versatility elsewhere on the roster. So that is where good defense can make a difference. But where, when you talk about these teams like the Hawks or, the Clippers, like, if you just shut off one thing and they have an immediate counter to it, that's borderline impossible to stop. It reminded me of a quote from my favorite video game, Bully for PlayStation 2. And I don't know how many people have played it, but basically the premise of the game is you're Jimmy Hopkins. Your mom is married to another weird dude who is taking her on a year-long cruise. Don't ask me why. And you get dropped off at Bullworth Academy, and there's a bunch of cliques who are all little pieces of shit, and you have to put them in their place. So you start with what's called the school bullies. You take out Russell, their leader. And soon after that, you take care of the preppies, they're called. You take care of the greasers, which are like these kids in leather jackets hanging around the auto shop. Get care of the nerds, take care of the jocks. They all have some, baggage that, they need to, they need their comeuppance. And so after that first chapter where you hear Jimmy's voice to start the cutscene in the second chapter, and he says, with Russell pacified, I could be forgiven for thinking my troubles at Bullworth were over. But this place is a rotten onion. Peel off one stinking layer, and there's another even smellier one beneath. So in this case, Jimmy is like defense in the playoffs, where if you peel off one layer of, the Sixers or a team that's not as doesn't have as many creation facets, then you can expose them. You can expose the onion because there's not many layers to it and you've peeled them off. Whereas a team like the Hawks or the Suns, especially when CP3's helpfully, we've been throwing out this term juice a lot because, and to me, it just means like having another layer of your onion once the defense peels off one layer. And so if you're the defense, you're constantly having to peel through these layers. Like, let's say the first layer is a Booker Ayton pick and roll. Oh, you peeled that off. Okay. They reverse it to CP3, attacks the closeout. Oh, you were helped weak side. Oh, you peeled off that layer. Oh, he hits the corner to Mikal Bridges. Okay. You attack the closeout hard. Eventually, you're going to not have enough time to peel all these layers. And if there's an onion at the end of the shot clock, they're getting a bucket. So that's a really roundabout way of saying that's when teams get exposed for not having enough layers to their onion. You don't get as many layers peeled in the regular season. So we might look at a team like the Sixers and the Suns and be like, oh, that's a pretty similar looking onion. But that's because a defense hasn't game planned for that onion. It hasn't schemed for that onion. And that's when you realize how many layers an onion truly has, I guess. And so there might be no difference in regular season output with a lot of these teams, but there is something at play that isn't being caught by regular season offensive rating since teams aren't being schemed for as hard.
I want to stick with the term juice for a second because I do hear it thrown about on pretty much any NBA-related podcast. A player has juice or a team has juice. So I think the way that I'm going to specifically define it is basically the relentlessness and, yeah, the puzzle, the figuring out the puzzle of defenses as an offensive player. And when you can combine that that relentless ability to attack and to learn on the fly, that's what makes a player particularly juicy. So if you think about Trae Young in Game 7, he was shooting really terribly for most of the game. And he just kept shooting, and he had that confidence. But even through all of that, he was creating lob attacks for Capella. He was creating open shots for teammates. He was making the defense just stay on their toes and create things for other players, letting Kevin Huerter get out there and do what he had to do. That was a juicy performance because he was out there making the defense bend to his will instead of allowing the defense to dictate what he's going to do. And so that's the primary aspect of juice, is being the one to dictate the terms of engagement as opposed to just reacting to how the engagement is going.
I totally agree with that kind of definition, that you want to be able to set the terms of engagement. And I think a couple of important sub-skills for that, and there are sub-skills that are important, especially in scouting primaries, but also scouting secondaries, obviously, because they inherit a lot of the same traits. But I think the sub-skills that I think are so important to that juice, that ability to keep defenses on their toes, PD describes it as it not mattering what pace is next as long as the defense doesn't know what pace is next either. That kind of change of pace, you just have to be able to keep defenses on their toes by keeping it unpredictable and keeping that change of pace different. A bag of tricks is really important, but sometimes it's, minor sub skills like that understanding of angles that Chris Middleton portrays. And the more of those sub skills, maybe it's an elite burst or something like that. It depends who you are and how you play, but the players who are most important and most juicy in that kind of primary creation role have a number of these tricks. And what makes them so special and so hard to stop in a 7-game series is that, scout as much as you want, you're not going to have enough time to figure out all their tricks. And even if you do, you're not going to know which one's coming next. And so I think that juice is true both of players with that on-ball kind of creativity, that change of pace, that burst, understanding of angles, things of that nature, but also with teams. And it portrays itself both on the offensive end and the defensive end. Maybe it's a number of facets of creation, like the Hawks have Bogey, Trey, and Huerter. Maybe it's different looks at the big spots. The Hawks have Capella as a true five, Collins, who can play either spot. They can go with Danilo Gallinari at the four, who offers elite spacing and self-creation as well. So they have so many different, like Scott said, layers of the onion that when it comes to 7-game series, even multiple 7-game series in a row, it's so hard to limit that juice because you just have to account for so much that it's just impossible to keep it all, on the mind long enough to stop it, or at least to stop it enough that you're not going to get beat by night-to-night variance. So that diversity is hugely important. And I think I almost maybe understated how important it was, or at least in how many different ways that diversity could portray itself, especially in the playoffs, especially watching the regular season. And that's just another thing that I've come to know. And I think it's something I always felt, but now I feel even stronger about it. Like, the season really needs to be shortened, because the game that we're seeing in the 72 games this season, or the 82 games of a normal season, is not the same as what we're seeing in the playoffs. And I think there's a number of reasons for that, but playoff ball is just different when you're playing these long seven-game series, when everything matters, when night to night it's all about counter and parry and fighting back and forth like that between two teams that are equipped and ready to go at it. Just trying to scheme for those seven game series with teams that have that juice. You don't have to see, or you don't get to see as much of that juice in the regular season, because the smart teams, I think, will hide it. And some teams are really just developing it, like the Hawks hit their stride late in the season, but it's a real thing. And it's hugely important both in players and in teams.
And right now, with this being, it's not the off season yet, but it's summer for me. So I join all time drafts, and I'm in the middle of an all time draft. And usually when I'm in these, I try and develop like, all right, I'm going to get my like main primary creator. And then we're going to surround that player with maybe a shooter here and a shooter here. I'm going to try and land somebody like Andre Kirilenko, because they can switch around and do stuff. Maybe in a later round, I'll try and sneak in Bam, because defensively he can switch around. He's really good. And I just need everything to like coherently fit in this really nice portable way. But now, like the current draft I'm in, I'm like, screw it. I have Michael Jordan. I'm going Walt Frazier. I have Gary Payton. I have Penny Hardaway. Yes, I drafted four point guards because I'm like, I put those four out there. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do? So what if you can't, if they can't like defend a big man? You can't stay in front of any of them. And good luck having four players that are going to be able to stand in front of him. You could have four Kawhis out there and you're still not going to stop the juice that that lineup has. And so that really is where my biggest takeaway is just worry about the portability, worry about the maximizing of fit later, and just get a bunch of players that can attack the basket, that can create off the bounce, and figure it out from there. Because once you have that, you can develop a really deadly attack that I simply don't know how you stop.
I think, you mentioned how you wanted to shorten the season. I think Nate mentioned that earlier to us. And he also said that, you know, kind of what this takeaway of the episode is, where he said, I'd rather have a bunch of, you know, viable looks as opposed to one really, really good one. And I think that's where our belief in the Bucks came in past years, where for me, I remember I was really bullish on them in the 2020 season, because I said, okay, Giannis is a one-man wrecking ball in transition. The only team that ever slowed him down in the playoffs just disbanded, just lost its best player in the Kawhi Leonard Raptors. And even they, you know, they were down 2-0 and won the next four games by a margin of 9 points. There was stuff that happened. Fred VanVleet caught fire, had a kid. So I was like, well, looking around, is there a team as good as that? I don't think so. You need like Gasol, Ibaka, Siakam, Leonard to like try to wall up Giannis. So what I failed to realize is it's actually fairly easier than I thought to take away one thing. Like, there hasn't been a thing yet that like hard counters what the defense tries to do. So not only is it's not specifically, you know, good offense beats good defense. Cause like, you know, we hear that when it's like good defense or better offense, when KD makes like a contested fadeaway, it's more that really versatile defense can't stop really versatile offense, like we're saying. They're just, no team can peel that onion to its core. And so you almost have to just pick your poison. Like, a lot of times we're seeing teams, you know, like the Jazz, for example, they just let Terrence Mann score 20 points in a quarter because, you know, they trotted out Reggie Jackson, Paul George, Terrence Mann, not Kawhi, Morris, I think Kennard might have been in for a bit. And it's like, okay, who do we let kind of do his thing? And it's like, okay, Terrence Mann is the least proven shooter of these people. And you really can only just stop one thing and hope the thing that you're allowing doesn't kill you, it seems like, on defense. So that definitely works in favor of a team like the Clippers and the Hawks, and less the Bucks, where they have a few really strong attacks that, you know, we've seen, like, you know, the Heat. I think the Nets were on their way to walling it up pretty well, but kind of the floor gave out in some other areas. So I guess where I'm at is I don't know if the Bucks will win this series, but we can talk about that later.
Yeah, and I'm honestly, we tried the prediction making thing last time, more or less, and I think after the first two games of Nets Bucks, we were like, holy shit, we built this up to be this fantastic series, and it's going to be a real stinker. And thankfully, we got a 7-game series, and it ended up being a really good one. But like, I guess if we needed to kind of, okay, so we talked around this a little bit when we started the podcast off, right? But the way that I think a lot of our philosophies have been trending as a result of some of the occurrences of this year's playoffs is kind of at odds with the Bucks' success. But when you consider how the Bucks got to where they are, right, the Heat series was pretty easy for them. But when it came to playing the Nets, like, they had almost no margin for error whatsoever. Game seven, Kevin Durant's like foot was on the line, like, and he wears extra big shoes. So like, that's essentially a miracle. They needed Harden to be like hamstrung. And even then, like, KD went off and had like an all-time good series, and the Bucks like had to take 7 games to get there. So, in terms of their margin for error, like, I'm almost leaning, I'm not going to make a prediction. I don't need to make a prediction, but, I guess even though the Bucks' kind of route to victory so far has been at odds with where our philosophy is going, their difficulty in getting to the end of that road, or, you know, the place they're at right now, lends some credence, I think, to where our philosophy is going. Because they've struggled more than probably they should have to, given the overall quality of their roster, especially in that Nets series. And it'll be really interesting to see how defensively, especially, they handle the multifaceted nature of what the Hawks do on offense. And I have kind of some difficulty believing that Bud is going to do anything but go with what he knows here. And Cody may have smarter, more insightful thoughts on that than I do.
Well, okay, so there's a defense point I want to bring up. I don't think it's going to fit super well here, but I'm going to put a pin in that, and I'm going to bring my defense point up a little bit later. But for the Bucks, I think something, part of their success actually, I think, goes along with our changing philosophy right now. Because what the Bucks have, they actually do have a solid amount of secondary creators. The issue is that they don't have a great primary creator, right? And so it's almost the opposite of what a lot of other teams have. They're like the opposite problem of the Jazz, where the Jazz have like, all right, we have Donovan Mitchell and a lot of people that are going to promote him, and that's going to be it. But the Bucks are like, all right, we have a bunch of guys that can kind of do stuff off a initial action, but we don't really have anyone that can really create that initial action. I also want to say that Giannis has really had a magnificent playoffs, and I feel like I'm seeing a lot more slander than I should be seeing of him. I mean, he's averaging like 30 points on really, really good efficiency. And even though he wasn't guarding Kevin Durant, he was all over the place defensively, just doing his roamer thing and just causing havoc that way. I mean, he wasn't creating like tons of turnovers and getting tons of blocks, but his just mere presence and ability to move off ball is really terrifying for other teams. And I think a big aspect is when he's able to play the five, I don't know of anyone else that can be more of a secondary creator at the five than Giannis can. So the Bucks actually do have a nice little built-up structure for going along with this philosophy that we have, but they're just missing that key piece. But right now, just like we saw back in 2019, all you need is a couple things to fall your way, and you're going to win the championship. Go back to 2015. The Cavaliers lost Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love. Warriors won the championship. All it takes is to just be near that level, which is what I was saying at the end of last year. Just stay the course, because you never know what happens, and you never know when you're going to be able to sneak in and win it all. And so, yeah, I think the Bucks' amount of secondary creation helps them a little bit more than people might be willing to give them credit.
And this kind of gets really semantic-y, but I'm going to try to parse between the Bucks' secondary creation and like the Hawks' secondary creation. I think Bucks have a lot of secondary creators, but not much secondary creation, because that implies the existence of primary creation. I think to make this all work, you need that initial dent maker that Trae Young is, and then you can activate the Herders and the Bogdanoviches. And it's why I'm not really sold that Bogdan would be this salve for the Bucks, like some say he was, just to torment Bucks fans. Because what I'm seeing is that, yes, they have all these like guys who can get middle efficiency shots like Jrue Holiday and Chris Middleton and, you know, Giannis in the half court, but their means of activating it, their primary creation is one thing, right? It can only be one thing. It can be Giannis in transition. That's when he has the impact of a primary creator. That's when he makes the Luka type dents and can pass guys open. But what we're seeing here in what we're seeing with the juicy teams, let's call it, not so much the Clippers. We can get to them and how they're a little bit more unique. But what we're seeing with the Hawks is, yes, they have the primary creator, and that's what activates this shoot, dribble, pass skill set of a Bogdanović, of a Kevin Huerter. That Bucks don't really get into that shoot, dribble, pass mindset with a lot of their players because that initial advantage hasn't been created. It's, I don't know if I'm getting this across, but the way of the future isn't just a bunch of shoot, dribble, pass guys. It's a bunch of shoot, dribble, pass guys and one guy who can create advantages nearly at will through multiple ways, right? Because what we're seeing with Juice is you have a counter to the counter to the counter. They peel off your onion, you go to the different onion. You go to the different layer of the onion. So I don't know if any of this makes sense, but I would say that the Bucks kind of run counter to what we're seeing works with having all these secondary creators, because at the end of the day, you still need some guy who can be unschemable unto himself. And, you know, a lot of teams have that in different ways. You know, not every primary creator has to be James Harden or LeBron James, but that is kind of the archetype for the unschemable player who activates every single other secondary creator.
I want to jump in and build on that by trying to paint a picture of what that might look like. So when you're watching the Bucks and you're watching them run an offense, a lot of it is, at least when it gets really bogged down, a lot of it is Giannis going in, running into some kind of wall named Blake Griffin, pounding the ball a little bit, seeing if he can find some kind of hook shot, seeing if he wants some spacers mid-range, finding out that doesn't work, and then kicking out to Holiday and Middleton and being like, all right, that didn't work. Your turn to try something. And then, you know, Middleton sometimes catches fire, and it works out. But when you think of like, all right, let's say that Trae Young was on the Bucks. Let's say we just took out Jrue Holiday and put Trae Young in there. He's so good at slicing into the paint that when he gets into the paint, the defense has to collapse onto him, and then all of a sudden you kick it out to Giannis, and Giannis is a runway, right? When Giannis is a runway, he's nearly impossible to stop. But right now, the way that they're running an offense, he really doesn't ever get that runway. So it's almost creating that runway for other players that the Bucks just don't have the ability to do.
Yeah, and I think one thing that frustrates me a little bit about the Bucks scheme, and this is a little bit in the weeds in terms of their schematic decision making, but in terms of giving Giannis a runway, like, I think they could do a lot better job of that if they would use him as the role man more often instead of relying on him to be the dribble creator. He can create off the dribble. Those long strides are like super unique, a trait, a micro skill that we've never seen before, like not utilized that way for sure. And Giannis makes great use of it, right? But when he's attacking the rim, he's also not going to convert on a lot of the free throws that he draws as a result of you know, drawing that contact and being unstoppable in that way. So there are trade-offs there. I just wonder if he could be buoyed a little bit more. And like, efficiency is not his problem, right? But in terms of a diversity of looks, I wonder if the Bucks offense, I guess, could be buoyed a little bit more by getting Giannis on the roll. And maybe the reason that they don't do that so often is just because they don't have an ideal primary or somebody who could fill in as a primary in those circumstances. But I'd like to see an opportunity where they give Jrue Holiday a little bit more pick and roll opportunities, getting Giannis on the roll and using the gravity that he creates, even without the ball going downhill, to give other guys easier opportunities, instead of telling Giannis to drive and kick so often or drive and score or drive and draw a foul. It's just kind of touches back on the kind of recurring theme of this podcast so far, that diversity is hugely important. And so if the Bucks can find a way to utilize Giannis in different ways that still play to his copious strengths, I think they'd be better off for it, especially on offense.
I think one of the final plays, it was either overtime or at the end of the regulation. You might remember this play better than I do, Cody, but I think they did specifically run a Chris Middleton Giannis pick and roll near the end somewhere. And I think it ended either in like a Giannis foul draw or he like kicked it out for three. I can't remember what happened, but that was me thinking like, all right, you know, I think there was a thing in The Athletic a couple years ago where each beat writer talked about the go-to play of that year. And I remember in 2020, Frank Madden highlighted the Middleton Giannis pick and roll. And one reason they, you know, were on a 70 win pace is they were going to that a little bit more that season. And for some reason, it's just, it really makes you appreciate guys like James Harden, who can like pretty much dictate the terms at will. It seems like they have trouble getting into that set. I don't know, maybe they don't prioritize it as much, but simply like spamming pick and rolls and getting good actions out of that seems something that only like a handful of guys can do. And then everyone else, you're just wondering why they can't do it, but it seems like they can't for some reason. Maybe it's easier to stop because of Middleton's lack of burst or handle. But I'm with you. Like, I want to see it work less often, because that means that they're trying it.
Yeah. And I just wanted to say, like, it's something that we see, or at least I saw in the Bucks games that I watched during the regular season, which admittedly wasn't as much as I would have liked, because I live in Wisconsin, so I can't catch them on League Pass because of the dumb blackout delays. But they ran it during the regular season more often, and a little bit anecdotal, but I don't see them run it very often in the playoffs. It's almost like they kind of capitulate to the pressure of the playoff situation, the idea that, you know, the winner of these playoff games is generally the team with the better player, and you want to give your better player as many minutes and as many touches as possible. So give Giannis the ball, tell him to make a dent, and he'll do it more often than he doesn't do it. And I wonder if they'd be better served by just mixing in a little bit of that diversity to keep defenses on their toes. Even though that first look can be really, really good, you can get the same results through different methods. You know, if you want to get Giannis on the free throw line or running downhill, like move him without the ball, just like you would moving him with the ball. And now you've got two looks, and teams have less opportunity to guess what you're going to do. So, yeah, I guess it's a little bit of complaining from me, but it is something I'd definitely like to see more. And maybe it's something they use more often against the Hawks. I think the Hawks are not super well suited to handling that action. And I think the Bucks are going to try and get Trae Young involved in pick and roll as much as possible. So maybe that means a little bit of Jrue Holiday, Giannis pick and roll. I guess we'll see.
I think the other thing that hurts the Bucks, and I'm going to bring this up cautiously, because I said some things the other night in private about a couple of players on the Bucks that I don't know if I 100% agree with anymore. But we have to talk about Jrue Holiday. We just do. And I think a really big part of it is when the Bucks traded away Eric Bledsoe and got Holiday, a big part of it was like, oh, teams aren't going to be able to help off anymore. Teams are going to have to respect him on the perimeter. And one of those big threes, I think it was in the fourth quarter when Holiday actually came through and made a couple of those shots. One of those threes he hits, he had like Ben Simmons amount of space. Like the Nets were completely ignoring him on the perimeter. And that is a big aspect that's taking away space from Giannis getting to the basket, is that the Nets were able to completely scheme off him, because Jrue Holiday is shooting like 46% true shooting during these playoffs, which is just putrid. He's shooting 15 times a game, and he's getting about two free throws a game, which is just not going to cut it for that level. He's shooting, looking at it right now, 24.6% from three during the playoffs. And I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what to do besides say something really hot takey, so I'm not going to say it. But what are you seeing from Holiday, and what do you have to say besides he just has to play better?
And so I feel like this entire year I was trying to like, I felt like I had this Jrue Holiday omniscience that I was just trying to bestow onto you, because I had like really covered the 2018 Pelicans pretty hard. They were a really fascinating team to me, even when Boogie Cousins got hurt and they got Mirotić, who shaved his beard and started, you know, shooting 40, 50, 90, easily 50, whatever, which one. But Jrue really had one of like the better self-creation seasons that year. You know, he was getting to the mid-rangers. He was shooting about 50% of them. He had the floaters. He had basically a lot of the stuff he's been doing now, except it goes in a lot more and he gets to it a lot easier. And so I thought, you know, this version of Jrue had been obscured by the Pelicans' messy situation in subsequent years. And once he, you know, had the opportunity to direct traffic, he would return to a semblance of his 2018 form. And that just really hasn't been the case. He just, I don't know if it's the injuries he sustained, you know, the fact that he's 31 and not 28. But he just isn't going to really meaningfully change the geometry, I guess, of the Bucks offense. I think even though he's been shooting like Bledsoe, he is a better shooter than Bledsoe normally. And so I stand by the fact that, like, he's not going to cause throw too much of a wrench into the Bucks offense the way Bledsoe might have when teams ignore him. But they are just kind of a similar team in how they manufacture looks. And when you consider that they traded all their, you know, picks in the near future for this solution, it seems like, I mean, I really don't trust the Bucks front office at this point. I think that they were naive to think that this team pre-Drew trade was the title favorite that I and other silly people thought they might be. I think they're a team that, you know, like we've talked about, has really good first couple layers of the onion. And, you know, it's no secret that once you peel back those layers, there isn't much under there. So I guess what I'm trying to say is he makes those layers better, but he's not adding a huge element that they were like desperately needed. And so to give up all your picks, it feels like this was more of like a co-move than the move to turn things around for Milwaukee.
Yeah, and I just want to get in a little bit because I think I'm a little bit higher on Drew than you guys. He started off the playoffs really well in my estimation, and yeah, he definitely hasn't kept it going the entire time. I think some of it is shooting variance. I agree with Scott. He's definitely a better shooter than Eric Bledsoe, no questions asked. And even if the results are the same, the perception of him as a shooter on the defensive part matters a lot. The closeouts he draws actually occur, as opposed to Eric Bledsoe, who does not really draw closeouts. And Drew is willing to shoot as well, so that keeps the cycle going. That said, Drew is definitely older now. You can see that his creation off the burst or off the dribble is not the same. The burst is not there quite as much. And I think it somewhat dulls what makes him special as an offensive player. But he's still useful there. And I think that what we've seen, you know, after that hot start in the playoffs is more or less an aberration, but I do agree with Scott. So this is where I would say Scott is actually a little bit in the middle. Cody is probably on the opposite end, but not really that different from me here. But I do think that the Bucks kind of played scared here. And what they did is they made a mistake, a clear mistake, I think, in my opinion, not paying up for Malcolm Brogdon. And then what they did is they took the first potential solution that they had offered to them in the Drew trade, and they didn't look back. And Scott, I think you're 100% correct. The onion is essentially the same onion. The layers just may be a little bit more special than they were before. The Drew is very, very similar to Eric Bledsoe. And I don't think he's a real game changer for the Bucks, especially offensively, in the way that a lot of us were hoping for. Me chief among them, I'm a big Drew Holiday guy. And I did think he was going to make a huge difference for the Bucks. So far, it's not looking like that's going to be the case. But we'll see, I guess, what next season brings and what changes the Bucks potentially bring. And honestly, we'll see if he can bring it back this playoff round in the conference finals, because I think he has a really good matchup on both ends against Trey, in a way that will be able to hopefully start the cycle for him and keep good performances going. But yeah, it so far has not inspired a lot of confidence. I totally agree.
This is just a fun aside, and I have, you know, been too low on Malcolm Brogdon in the past, but I don't know if he really changes their geometry of their offense too much. I know that that's like a sore subject because they let him walk, but like, I think of how he's won and on what terms. And I do think that Sabonis probably gets the credit, but like even so deserves a ton of credit for just being a hub within that offense. It's like what Ben Taylor talked about with Jokic, where it's like, oh, I don't have a good look, I'm going to reset it to Jokic and he's going to reverse the ball or like have some, you know, self-creation on the elbow. And I think Sabonis is kind of a Diet Coke version of that. But but I think that Brogdon gets stuck a lot of the times because the way his game is predicated, it's get separation on the pick and roll. If they play off me, pull up for the mid-ranger. If, you know, they're a little close to me, I do have that, you know, wide body and I can ward off defenders and get to the rim. And I feel like that's fairly easy to scheme for. I'm kind of content making Malcolm Brogdon mid-range me to death. I don't think he has any semblance of a pull-up three. So at this point, I think there's you can just hard counter that by kind of dropping against him. And without that release valve of Sabonis, I think that Malcolm Brogdon being asked to create on the Bucks is just going to be a lot of pull-up, like 40% looks from two. And so I struggle to see the juice with him. I struggle to see the counter to the counter. And maybe they could, you know, use Giannis in a similar way. They use Sabonis to kind of, you know, use the roll man to kind of catalyze the pick and roll ball handler. But gosh, guys, I think it's another Drew situation where you're like, oh, that guy would be better than Bledsoe. And then he is, but he isn't.
And for me, the complaint is I totally agree with your Brogdon assessment, like 100% basically. But the problem for me is the Bucks allocation of resources and what that put them into after they decided not to pay up for Brogdon. So I'm thinking like just basically that their ceiling would look at least like a little bit stronger version of this if they did in fact keep Brogdon. But it's really not super relevant given that they made the decisions they made. I just wanted to say that like I think their front office played a little scared and it had ended up capping their ceiling. So from a philosophical standpoint, just like and this is not, you know, really the front office's choice, probably. Honestly, ownership was probably not willing to pay up. But when you do have the chance to keep a guy in the building and the only decision is whether or not you want to pay the tax and you're a contender, you should probably pay the tax. That's more, I guess, advice to owners than it is to front offices. But we have like a ton more that I want to get into, especially in terms of a couple of the philosophical considerations around I know two players for sure that I want to talk about who are no longer with us in the playoffs. Do we want to transition to that, or do you guys have anything more you want to talk about on Bucks?
Yes, I want to come in and ask Scott a question because I feel like I really, 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 really disagree with you right now. Are you saying that you don't think the Bucks would be appreciably better on offense if everything else is the same and they just had Brogdon right now?
I'm saying I don't know, because I guess the butterfly effect is do they trade for Drew? But let's say they had Brogdon instead of Drew, right? I guess that's what I'm trying to say. I see Brogdon as a solid additive player if you have the infrastructure in place. But for all these guys who like people point to as like, oh, that will, you know, change the Bucks offense, I don't think Brogdon is one of them. I think it looks very similar. I think Brogdon's a very deliberate player. He has a very similar attacking style as Drew, where, you know, he kind of does what he does. And then if he doesn't do it, then he's kind of stuck. I think, you know, having Sabonis has kind of obscured a lot of that in Brogdon's game. Again, I do not think he's as good as everyone thinks he is, but, you know, that's just how I feel. And I guess what I'm trying to say is even maybe with Brogdon on the team, they would be better. But I think the problem I still have with them is that they, you know, they're not one of these infinite counters teams. And I think that stems from having one type of primary creator guy who's you're not able to scheme for. And basically they would be better at skirting around that problem with Brogdon, but I don't think he would necessarily solve that problem.
All right. I'm glad you clarified that, because I just think, you know, I'm looking around at the team right now and I'm saying I would much rather have Brogdon out there than Bryn Forbes or Pat Connaughton on offense. But if you're saying the counterfactual is that there's no Drew, then yeah, I agree with you. And I also agree with Evan, because I would like to move on and talk some other philosophical stuff, even though I do love the Bucks.
Yeah, just to put a bow in it, I guess what I was trying to say is the crux of that team and why I don't really trust them to win the championship would still be there, but they would be a better team with Brogdon and Drew. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that definitely makes sense, especially when you consider like they lost Dante DiVincenzo, who is an important player on both ends, but I think especially on defense. Imagine if they still had Brogdon. That hurts a lot less. But yeah.
My issue with the Bucks is still there. They're just a better team with Brogdon.
Better version of the same problem.
Yeah. Like, does that make sense, Cody?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Maybe they're so good, and part of this is, you know, part of this is we have to give the Bucks their flowers. You know, they did play a depleted Nets roster, but they did advance. And, you know, sometimes heuristics only take you so far, right? I hate the expression rule of thumb because of its origins, but one quote I heard is like, you know, rule of thumbs are good, but if you only use your thumbs, then you're going to be clumsy. So that's how I guess I consider the Bucks. You know, like I have my bone to pick with the way they're constructed and how they don't have that unschemable player, but they could win anyway. And that's, they would have a better chance to do that with Malcolm Brogdon, but that heuristic would still be in place for me and the Bucks. I guess is all I'm trying to say. And the same goes with Bogdanovich. Like, I don't know if he's solving that problem. He could be solving other problems, but not that problem. So I guess the players you guys wanted to talk about who are no longer in the playoffs, I'm going to guess that it's Rudy Gobert and that it's Ben Simmons. Is that correct?
You are 100% spot on. The timeline has been ablaze. Yeah, and you don't even have Twitter.
Yeah, well,
the timeline has been ablaze.
I see, you know, basically I was shared two like tweets from StatMuse who really like, you have all this proprietary data and cool statistics department, and you're just using it to dunk on Gobert and Simmons like everybody else.
It's a narratives-based stat presentation account, that is for sure. I know the tweets you're talking about, the Rudy and Ben tweets.
It's like,
and they were gratuitous.
Okay, man, cool. You made a little cartoon of the player, and you just said what everyone else is saying, but you have a blue check next to your name, and you're a stats website. I don't know how much of this I'm going to edit out.
Seems reasonable. It's good to get it off your chest, though. I mean, like, I don't follow StatsMuse, but I did see the tweets you're talking about, and they were really bad. Like, they're designed just for people to quote, tweet, and meme about these players who, like, what we're about to do is a real philosophical discussion on what
real
it means
shit,
to
man.
Roster these players and what you need to put around them to make them successful. Because what Premium Hoops is about and what Sense and Scalability is about is discussing... Every player that's in the NBA is good. Like, you don't get to the NBA by being fucking shit at basketball. You're good. It's just that, you know, the best players are many times more scheme agnostic or context agnostic than some of the less notarized players. But that doesn't mean that players, you know, don't have a utility. And I think what we're finding with Ben, and we talked about it with Rudy a little bit earlier, but with Ben and Rudy, it's important that you find a way to contextualize them that maximizes what makes them so special while limiting what makes them so frustrating sometimes. And I can't think of a better example of this than Ben Simmons, right? And in his own estimation, he did not have a good series. He said he deserved the boos from the Philly fans and that he expected them. What makes Ben Simmons so special is his ability to kind of dissect the game. And I know sometimes he's a bit of a pre-planner when it comes to making passing decisions, especially in the half court. But in transition, he's a truly special creator, both for himself and for others. Now, the problem becomes that the jump shot is clearly not there, right? And that was an issue that was on full display for the Sixers. Like, frankly, just bluntly, to put it right up there, you said it, Scott, at the top of the pod. The Sixers relied on Seth Curry to do a lot more on offense than he should have had to do. And that's because the other player on their roster that's on a max contract, or another player on their roster that's on a max contract, who you'd expect to handle a lot of that secondary creation, is Ben Simmons. Teams could kind of commit to Joel Embiid a lot more than they probably should have been able to, given the quality of Simmons as a player. But when the jump shot's not there, you have to find other ways to get him involved. And that's been a frustration for me that I think is honestly going to result in him probably being on another team at the start of next season. What do you guys think?
I just feel relieved because I think that I bought into this like Ben Simmons stuff where I'm like, I think that appreciating Ben Simmons became some sort of in-crowd signaling to show that you understood ball. And I think we were all kind of big braining ourselves into being like, oh yeah, Ben Simmons is good. Look at how well he passes and look how well he defends. But what you're talking about, Evan, is, and I always think of this piece by Mitch Libanoff, who I know listens to this show, and thank you, Mitch. And thank you for writing about this piece, 'cause I love it, but it's about viewing skills in tandem. And all of a sudden, if he's presenting no scoring threat, that preternatural passing, that, you know, physical frame, it's just not as good. It becomes, I don't know, Brandon Ingram's passing or something, because it's just, the same passing utility is not there when he can't put any pressure on the hoop.
Can we call it Kyle Anderson's passing?
Yeah, it becomes Kyle Anderson's passing. exactly. So, but like just a worse passer is what I was trying to say. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at, where I kind of had my like come to Jesus moment where I'm like, oh wait, he really isn't that helpful in the context of this team. And I'm just trying to like, you know, make sense of kind of being in this front, kind of like drinking the Kool-Aid for all these years. I still think he's a good player, but yeah, I think we, you know, as much as we rolled our eyes at the people who thought that they and only they could see that Simmons and Embiid were a bad fit and one needed to be traded. I think they're right. Like this is not working. Maybe it's because Ben has kind of lost some of his spark for basketball. Honestly, I don't think he's having a good time out there right now, but yeah, I just feel like I've awakened from this like coma. Like I feel like a celebrity just realizing I was in Scientology for 4 years. And now like I have to make sense of my life.
So we talked about this. I don't even remember which episode it was. We've so many episodes now, I can't cite specific ones, but I think it was in our conversation comparing Thaddeus Young's and Draymond Green's passing, because I think a lot of people might be hearing this and be like, wait a second, how can Draymond Green make use of his passing then if he has pretty much like Ben Simmons level scoring punch, especially now? And I think it has to do with just the aggression that he takes it to the hole. And I think that was really encapsulated by that driving pass out that Simmons had, where he had a pretty easy layup or dunk and kicked it out to a thigh ball in traffic. And Draymond doesn't do that. He shoots and he misses, but he at least shoots and he takes it into you and he's driving at you, making you think he's going to shoot and making you think that he's going to dunk on you and making you think he's going to score. And that's the sort of aggression that opens up a lot of lanes for him. And that's the aspect that is keeping Ben Simmons back, because we've seen a lot of players that don't necessarily have a strong scoring ability who are able to open things up with their passing. Guys like Draymond Green, guys like Rajon Rondo. And so you're right. It almost does feel joyless. And I don't know how to analyze that. And I don't want to go too deep into that because I don't want to play armchair psychologist. But you're right. It does feel like he's doing it scared, more so as like, I'm going to assert myself in this sport that I love and dedicate things to.
So I want to jump in here and just say, touch on a couple points that you guys talked about. So in terms of Ben Simmons, especially getting to the rim as a scorer, he has all the tools to get there more or less no problem. It's that when he gets there, I think he has a contact aversion that's a problem. Because one, he doesn't want to go to the line. His free throw shooting is terrible. He knows it. Other teams know it. Teams like will literally hack Ben Simmons to put him on the line. It's that bad. And he knows it. And so he doesn't want to shoot free throws because it's an inefficient shot. And Ben Simmons is a smart player. Like he knows what's going on. It's just that his wiring and how he interprets what the best solution is different, because he wants to find the best solution and he knows that him getting to the line is not it. And so I think there's a little bit of contact aversion there from a free throw perspective because he doesn't want to shoot. But I think there's also some biomechanical stuff, and I won't claim to know about this fully in depth. But our good pal Polar at Polarfall on Twitter has talked about Ben Simmons and his contact aversion before. So I'll see if I can find this tweet and retweet it out, so you can find this when you listen to the podcast. Maybe come look at my feed and see if you can find it. But that I think is a factor too. So between the contact aversion, both for physical reasons and for psychological reasons, Ben Simmons takes away, I think, his best pathway to success in the half court, which is as a downhill rim attacker, because he limits himself from finishing at the rim for a number of reasons. And that exacerbates the problem that is the non-shooting. Cody, like you said, there are ways to get guys like Ben, and comparing Ben to Draymond is not something I like to do very frequently, but there are parallels to be drawn. I think when you want to get those slightly more limited offensive players utilized in the half court, there are ways to do it, especially running pick and roll and getting them as the roll man, that Ben isn't being utilized in frequently enough. And I don't think always has the best solution when he's put in those circumstances. One of the quotes, I think, and I kind of want to disagree with you guys, because I think it's not necessarily like a lack of joy, or I do think there's an element of fear there in the sense that, like we talked about, it's just not a smart decision for him sometimes to attack the rim, and he knows it. an interview that he gave after the game kind of enlightened me a little bit to how he thinks about this. And there was a situation that he was asked about, and I don't remember the exact play, but he was basically asked why he was occupying the dunker spot and instead of stretching out to the corner. I think it was the weak side corner. And I want to say Nikias tweeted this out today. Ben basically walked through the play, and he was able to rationalize why him standing in the dunker spot was a better idea and better for the team's success in the half court than doing the traditional solution and stretching out because he wasn't going to shoot. But he essentially admitted that he's calculating what is the best opportunity at the time, but he's not thinking about what is the best avenue for him to develop. And I think Ben Simmons understands that there is a way for him to play the game of basketball to a high degree of success. And I don't think he wants to deviate from that, because the short deterrence from what makes him so successful will make him less successful in the short term. So it's not worth adding at the time. And I think this is why he doesn't probably work so much on the shooting in the offseason as I think we would all like. I don't have reports to this, but I have heard that, like, you know, he had a plan from the Sixers last offseason to do training specifically with the free throw and then with the jump shot. And he decided he would rather work with somebody he knew through Clutch instead. And as we see, like, that's not going to cut it. Like, he's not going to add the jump shot, and it's going to be a serious disadvantage. But I'm sure you guys will want to touch on probably something I said there. But I also want to ask what you guys think in the interim, while Ben Simmons is working on that jump shot, hopefully, and hopefully adding that jump shot, what is the best team context to utilize what makes Ben Simmons so great on both ends? And what are some teams that can put that context, make that context available to him? Because I don't think it's going to be the Sixers.
Before we go into that question, I just want to say that I don't think any player in recent memory has broken the concept of ranking players as hard as Ben Simmons has, because we're talking about him like he's this problematic, you know, offensive player, and he has been. But this was a guy who, if you look at our like abandoned premium hoops top 100 players, he was like an 18, 20, 22, you know, depending on the person. And this is a guy who's been considered a top 30 player for the last couple of years. So I just wanted to, you know, do the opposite of a hat tip towards ranking players, because we get pigeonholed into these ideas that this guy is firmly entrenched in this range. And as we're seeing, like, it's such a weird, fluid game and things can change so quickly and players are so unique. I don't know where I'd rank Ben Simmons. And I feel like that's a question you don't really need to ask yourself right now, because it's, you know, clear that at the highest levels, his current situation isn't extracting what he's good at on offense. You know, he's still a good defender, but, you know, if you're a top 30 player, you'd want to at least have something on offense, which we're talking about as this like dominant force when it can be done with versatility and proficiency. So I just, you know, I'm going to try to be ranking agnostic with Simmons as I try to make sense of that last series. That being said, I do think that, you know, another reason rankings are silly is because it is tied to team context. And yes, you know, you do hear things like, oh, you know, anyone could do what Dwight Powell does and run to the rim. Eventually, you do have to give those players their flowers for, you know, thriving in that role and putting up, you know, good production. So I guess that's two sides of the coin. But in this case, it means that, you know, I would probably, I guess if I had to rank Simmons, rank him higher if he was put in a team where his specific skills were, you know, maximalized. And what I think that is what you're talking about, just being a role man. Like, let's just say the Clippers have no way to do this, but let's say you just, you know, get Simmons as their center and you have Reggie Jackson, Terrence Mann, Batum, you know, Kawhi, Paul George, you know, four of those guys. And then you put in Simmons at the five, where yes, you kind of abandon that five out shoot dribble pass identity, but this is a team that likes to get out in transition. You know, you can have Ben Simmons set screens for guys like Paul George, who will demand doubles off the pick and roll, basically how they used Rondo. And, you know, and that might actually be his optimal skill set at this point. And, you know, a 6'10 Rondo is still a really good player. Like, that's not an insult. Like, if Rondo was 6'10, he probably, like, you know, in his prime could have been like a top five player. I don't think that's crazy.
I don't think that's crazy at all.
I don't know if this is what you were going for, but I was thinking about this while you two were talking. Why don't we just run Ben Simmons at center? Why doesn't he just become the revolutionary center for a new team somewhere? In that context you just described with the Clippers, sounds like a really good situation for him. And I think that would really utilize what he does well on offense in a way that would scramble defenses. And, you know, he's big enough and he's good enough at defense that I don't think that it would effectively lose too much in the playoffs on the defensive end. I'm still going to be bringing up my defensive point at some point, but I'm biding my time here. But you don't necessarily need to start Ben Simmons at center and play him there the entire time. I think off the top of my head when we were talking about this last night, Chicago came up as one of the first options. I still would like to see them have a primary creator, because I do think LaVine is more of that secondary type creator in the Chris Middleton type role. But being next to LaVine and being next to Vucevic, both of whom are not strong defenders, but can create for others, can do things for themselves, I think that would be a really interesting context for him. And then I think even in that situation, if you want to talk about the playoffs being a time where you need to be able to vary it up, he'd be a great backup center behind Vucevic, because if Vucevic isn't working, Simmons might work. That might be exactly the kind of thing that you're looking for in the playoffs. So that's probably the first place I would think of when it's the perfect context for Simmons.
Yeah,
and I think...
Go ahead, Scott. You're good.
I think there's been a lot of Simmons at the five pushback because the on-offs haven't always shown it whenever Sixers do try to go with that look. And I do think that has actually kind of obscured how well it could work on the right team. Just maybe as like a, you know, as Cody's saying, like a change of pace look or like a playoff look, the way the Clippers are doing, you know, de-emphasizing Zubac in the rotation. But I think that it's been obscured because I think Clippers are kind of conditioned to funnel everything towards Embiid. I think that is their most likely play type. Like, in, you've played Draft Day Sports College Basketball Simulator, right, Evan?
Yeah, I sure have.
Oh, yeah. So you know how you like when you drill a certain... You drill a certain play type, like you're doing the Princeton offense, then all your players would get proficient at that, so that if you just switch offenses midseason, they won't be as good because it factors in, you know, experience with that. I think the Sixers defense kind of has that a little bit with funneling stuff towards Embiid, and it's very demanding to ask them to like switch identities on the fly. I guess if you get Matisse Thybulle and Danny Green out there with Ben Simmons, you know, that's a little bit of it, but you really need, like we've talked about, you know, drop bigs are kind of the heliocentrism of defense, where it's like, if you don't have that, you need everyone else to be on the same page, making rotations, trapping, hedging, blitzing, being comfortable in rotation. And I think that's why the Clippers' small looks have worked when they have worked. Sometimes the defense is horrendous. Sometimes they switch indiscriminately. But when they are able to turn it on against the Jazz, you see everybody on the team flying around covering for each other. You know, even Marcus Morris is getting in the action. Reggie Jackson, low-key has 7-foot wingspan, is able to fly out to shooters better than expected. And so, yeah, the Sixers have never really been built like that. But if you put Simmons on a team that's comfortable in those moments, like the Clippers, all of a sudden, you know, the sun of your heliocentric drop big doesn't have to burn as bright if everybody's comfortable, you know, being the part-time rim protector and then recovering out to the shooter.
Yeah, and I think what we're seeing with the Sixers is that when you have a player who's as good as Joel Embiid is, you kind of, especially on both ends, you build both your offensive and your defensive identities around that player. And so a lot of Philly's offense is predicated on Joel Embiid post-ups, as it should be, or creating through Joel in different means. And a lot of their defense is designed to funnel things towards him, because I think that's what maximizes their chances of winning. But what's a little bit unfortunate about that, at least for Ben Simmons, is that schemes that maximize what makes Joel Embiid so special minimalize what makes Ben Simmons special. And it marginalizes him to doing things that he's not as good at. So Cody, I love that you mentioned Chicago as a context, because when you think about Ben Simmons, you think about his major flaw being his jump shot, right? I think there's not many better teams in the league that can contextualize a relative non-shooter or he's a non-shooter, like Ben Simmons, than a team with shooters like Vooch and LaVine, who are going to draw so much defensive attention as two high yield creators who can shoot the three and who love to space out. That's going to give Ben Simmons so much room to work downhill. They can run pick and roll. Either Vooch and Ben can run pick and roll. Vooch and LaVine could run pick and roll. And LaVine and Ben could run pick and roll. And there's a lot of different wings that you could put around them and maybe even another guard if you'd like to increase the diversity of looks that you have available to you, especially on the offensive end. And so that was my ideal fit. I guess I don't want to go too much deeper into like trade shopping Ben Simmons, just because we've still got playoff games to talk about. And I wanted to talk about one other player, Scott, the one that you correctly mentioned in Rudy Gobert. But I think before I get started, if Cody has thoughts ready, drop bigs and Rudy Gobert are Cody's forte. So I'd love to hear his thoughts before I give mine.
So I'm going to tie in a bunch of players that we've actually been talking in tonight that leads us into Rudy Gobert. So I've seen this multiple times. I'm not being like people say, and I'm referencing like one person. This is actually like multiple people in multiple different situations that I've seen where people are like, I'm not voting Rudy Gobert ever again for Defensive Player of the Year, or, oh, get Ben Simmons out of first team all defense and things like that. And so, you know, I'm thinking about these playoffs. Kevin Huerter, when you think about Matisse Thybul, Joel Embiid, and Ben Simmons being on the same team, a player like Kevin Huerter shouldn't step up and be able to score, right? And people are like, oh, maybe Thybul and Simmons are overrated. And then you watch the Clippers and you watch the Jazz and you say, Gobert is overrated. He can't step out for three. And then you go and you watch the Bucks and the Nets play and you see Drew Holiday get cooked over and over by Kevin Durant. And you're like, oh, Holiday can't guard him one-on-one. And my first reaction is, if we're pointing out four of the best defenders in the league and saying that we're not voting for them, number one, who are you voting beyond those four? And number two, if those are the ones with the problem, maybe we have to think about defense as a whole as the problem and not those specific defenders. And that's where I've been really stuck right now, is when I'm thinking about these players that are supposed to bring immense value with their defense, they're not. They're just simply not right now. And so I've been defending guys like Thybul. I've been defending guys like Gobert all season long. But I think it's really hard to ignore that defensive impact just doesn't have the same value in the playoffs. And I'm not even talking like drop big defense. I'm talking single individual defense across the board. I think I would 100% rather just a bunch of players that are average at defense and good at offense, as opposed to having a few players that are really good at defense, because that just doesn't seem to bring the same sort of opposite end juice, the tenant juice, so to speak, that's going to go against the grain.
And I actually had a very similar thought that we talked about on Premium Hoops Pod when Henry, Mark, and I did the episode on bigs and kind of the future of the big role. But I think I remember specifically saying that if you're going to make me choose between, like, I guess a one-way offensive only five in Vooch or a one-way defensive only five in Rudy Gobert, and like the difference in quality is important. So I'd probably still take Gobert just because he's just better at defense than Vooch is at offense probably. But more often than not, I think I'm going to take the offensive only one-way big, just because the gains that you get from having a spacing threat, like a shooter or a creator like a Vooch or a Nikola Jokic, at the five are just massive. And yeah, you're going to get huge gains from a rim protector like Rudy Gobert. But when the balance of the game is so tilted towards offense still, it's just tough for me to make any other decision than taking the guy who's going to make my offense super, super special and, nigh impossible to stop in the right context with the right pieces around him. So I totally agree. Like, I think when you think about the playoff success of some of the league's best defensive players, and granted, yeah, there are tons of, you know, still very, very good defensive players and teams still left in the playoffs. The Suns and the Bucks are both great defenses with great defensive players. I do think there are legitimate concerns about like how valuable is defense when compared to offense at each position, and how much are you willing to, make up for in other areas to fit a player who's really strong in only offense or in only defense. And I was already leaning towards offense before, but I think I'm leaning even further now.
And not only, you know, bigs with skill who can like space to three, but it's so important just to have the big augment your inside scoring sometimes. Like, I think of DeAndre Ayton and how there's so many situations where the average big you know, might not have the touch to finish those bunnies or might not have the ability to explode over contact and, you know, dunk and get the end one or like, you know, explode through for the second jump put back. And I think the Warriors are still like, we're still recovering. Our brains still in pieces on the floor from when they trotted out Kevon Looney and Zaza Pachulia and won a bunch of rings. I know Draymond was kind of like the functional center, but the idea was that you could just put in any old center and they'll figure it out. But I would say that Suns offense would be like drastically worse if they had like say Nerlens Noel, like a center on the minimum over DeAndre Ayton. Like it's just become like any other position where the better your center is, the less, you know, you can have in terms of perimeter juice. Now Suns have both and that's why they're so hard to stop, but they're doing this, you know, what they did to the Clippers without Chris Paul, I think is a lot because Ayton balances out the scoring threats, you know, and the Warriors had so many scoring threats on the perimeter that it didn't really matter who the center was. Most teams aren't built like that. And I just wanted to give DeAndre Ayton his flowers because I think I called him the best play converter big currently in the NBA. And what I mean by that is anybody who gets a catch from within like 8 feet, I think DeAndre Ayton has the most ways to put that eventually in the hoop. And also those ways are all very good. And so I'm just really bullish on him and I want people to not take him and like the Valanciunases and the other like inside scoring monsters who might not give everything you want back on defense, but just that role really matters to me is I think what the Suns are teaching. And yes, it's kind of context dependent. They have excellent spacing that allows Ayton to do his thing. But if you have that spacing, I really think that's going to be something more and more people are going to catch on as Suns, in my estimation, continue to progress through the playoffs.
Yeah, and I'm glad we're giving DeAndre Ayton his flowers. I said he was going to be the kind of critical piece for any Suns run or at least for getting past the Lakers. And he's just been even better than I could have ever possibly dreamed. Like, he's been amazing in these playoffs. I guess, like, so the example you gave when you talked about the Warriors trotting out Kevon Looney and Zaza Pachulia, there are opportunity costs associated with each roster decision you make and where you allocate those resources. And I think if you determine that the big spot is, like, the five spot is probably the least important, at least in the way that you choose to build your roster, if you have perimeter creation available to you, then you would naturally allocate the fewest resources to that. The Suns didn't even have to make that decision because they have their third star on a rookie contract as their big, and he's scheme versatile. Like, you cannot ask for a better situation from a contributing five for a playoff contention run than what DeAndre Ayton is doing right now on a freaking rookie contract. He's been incredible, and he's been better than I could have possibly hoped for, and he's a big reason why the Suns have gotten as far as they have, and I think he'll be a big part of the Suns potentially getting even further and making it to the finals or maybe even winning it all, God willing, as a lifelong Phoenix Suns fan man.
First of all, no. I was going to say nice things about you, but no. I want you to retract that statement. But that is a really good point about Ayton being on a rookie deal. I actually didn't think about that. That's probably embarrassing because I'm sure that's come up on the timeline and I just haven't been paying attention to that.
I don't think it has. At least not the mention of him being on a rookie deal. But
the timeline or the Suns podcast called The Timeline.
I didn't even know that was a thing. Shout out The Timeline. Good work, The Timeline.
Shout out Phoenix Suns content creators, baby. The Suns content creation, very short aside, has been really incredible this playoff run as well.
I think that's with Mike Lisboa and Sam...
Sam Cooper?
Sam Cooper, yeah. Mike Lisboa and Sam Cooper, yeah. And then there was one called 7 Seconds or Less with Max McCauley and David Nash. I don't know if that's a thing anymore, but they were also great. They had a segment called 7 Plays or Less, where they would just do like clips of certain games. And I'm happy that they're all happy right now.
That's clever. I like that setup. Something I want to say about secondary creation and kind of tying this all together is that I think what we've been talking about does seem like we're enamored with guard play and wing play and things like that, but scoring in the post definitely counts as secondary creation. And I think we actually had a hard time pegging down Jokic as a primary creator during our what I don't even remember, one of our podcasts before. But big men like Embiid definitely are secondary creators, and that's why they didn't have quite enough juice, is because he is a secondary creator and he can't be the primary guy to start things because he can't bring the ball up and initiate in that way. But something that really hurts with Rudy Gobert, and this has been brought up a lot, the defense was definitely exposed a little bit. I don't want to say exposed because that makes it sound like he was always bad, but something that took advantage of his weaknesses was the Clippers. But the other thing is he couldn't punish them on the other end. Gobert's not the guy that you're going to throw it into the post and beat up on a smaller player. And so I would really love to see what would happen, let's say if the Clippers were to have been able to play the 76ers. What would happen if the Clippers played that lineup against Embiid? Would that proposition work out for them? I mean, the math of threes versus free throws versus post-ups definitely wouldn't, but Embiid is really, really good at getting fouled. And that raises one's true shooting percentage even more than shooting threes at a high clip. So I would love to see if you could run a true small ball lineup against Embiid and have that work out.
And that's what makes the Suns impossible, in my opinion, and that's why they're cooking with gas right now, is because if you really try to just wall up the paint, you're giving something to their bevy of scoring options and Mikal Bridges and Cam Johnson and Cameron Payne and Jay Crowder. Even's been, you know, another crazy Jay Crowder shooting playoffs. But then if you go all in on that and you try to go small, then all of a sudden you have to deal with Ayton, you know, catching those passes, lobs, dump off passes. They really killed the Clippers with those, to nobody's surprise. And it's only going to get worse once CP3 gets cleared. So they kind of are their onion has the most layers out of any team right now, I like to think. And all those layers are all really, really viable. You know, they're all going to make you cry.
They have some potent layers. They are going to make you cry. Tears of joy if you support them and tears of pain if you don't. Shouts out to you, Cody, not supporting my Phoenix Suns. My bright future for you. No, I'm just kidding.
You live in Wisconsin. What are you doing right now? Stop it.
Hey, I'd support the Bucks if I could watch the games, but NBA League Pass blacklist got me down bad, King.
That is fair. Anti-shout out NBA League Pass. Do better. LeBron GIF. Do better.
I think that does it for this podcast, though. We're going to be watching a lot of games. This is coming out Tuesday. Tonight we have game one of Hawks Bucks, I believe, and game two of Suns Clippers, both of which should slap. And we'll probably, again, have a sporadic playoff cycle. I'm not even going to check our reviews, because I don't think we're at 48, and I'm just too locked in. I'm too locked in to care about reviews right now. You can't shake me from this playoff grind. Okay. I've just received a programming note. Bucks Hawks is Wednesday. Thank you, Evan, for the wonderful utilization of Zoom chat. Yeah, that's a thing. And that's nice, because then I don't have to watch two games in a row like I've been doing, and my eye strain is killing me. All right. That does it, everybody. Enjoy the playoffs. Have a good rest of your day, as our guy Mark Schindler says. And I'm going to go play some PGA Tour 2K21. Bye, everybody.